Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowery. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these folks. The conversation is live and spontaneous. So pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today we are talking to Chris Quirk. Chris, welcome to Zero Hour. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
And, you know, I just said in here, you know, an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene, people that make it happen. But you're not from Richmond.
No, I'm not.
Yeah, you've had a big life change recently. Talk about that for a sec.
Well, my wife and I have been in Brooklyn for about 12 years and just recently relocated to Hudson, New York, a couple hours upriver from New York.
Yeah. So. Okay. Let me give a little information about Chris. Chris's paintings have been exhibited since 1990 in galleries both in the United States and abroad, including the Armory for the Arts, Santa Fe, New Mexico, and the Walsh Gallery at Seton Hall University, South Orange, New Jersey, the Atlantic Center for the Arts, New Smyrna Beach, Florida, the Alice K. Rogers Gallery at the St. John's University, Collegeville, Minnesota, Coyote Gallery, Chicago, and Temple University, Rome Gallery. He has received grants from the Kittredge Fund of Augusta, Maine, Change Inc. of Captiva, Florida, and the Arts Fellowship of New York City. He holds an MFA in painting from the Tyler School of Art in Rome and Philadelphia, and an MA in liberal arts education from the Graduate Institute of St. John's College in Santa Fe. So did you actually start, when did you start doing this? Were you interested in this as a child? Did this interest in painting progress? When did this start for you?
I was not interested in art at all as a child. I started, I think probably my visual awakening was in high school. We had an extraordinary teacher named Doc Costantini who brought us in and showed us some clips of some terrific movies by Antonioni and Fellini, many others. And that was the first time I really began looking at things visually in that way and studying them more closely. So I studied film in college for a while, but found the process to be a little bit indirect. Didn't enjoy working with people as much. Wanted to work alone and have the immediacy of seeing what I was working on and doing as I worked on it. So, and not the distance of the film process where you have to have the...
So did you make films for a while?
I did. Yeah. Make some short films when I was there, yeah.
Yeah. Huh. But you want the because I was reading, I guess, on your blog or either on your website or something about the sort of the struggles, I guess, that you've had being able to use painting as a medium to express what it was you wanted to express. Does that ring a bell for you?
Well, I guess I'm a little skeptical about the idea of expression. I'm not sure that what happens in painting is a kind of transference of any kind of information or communication necessarily from person to person via the medium of the painting or the art object. So I've done...
That's really interesting. I mean, that's an interesting statement. So you're sort of skeptical about the ability of painting to transfer information from the artist to the viewer?
Yeah, I think something clearly is happening. And if you look at the dynamic between the person that makes the artwork, the art object itself, and then what happens when the viewer looks at it, internalizes it to some degree, and puts it into their work, and then brings it into the world in a different way, that's an interesting dynamic to me. But it's hard for me to see how what happens there has something maybe that you'd call content involved. In other words, is it the case that somehow I'm putting some kind of information into this object, which is in a sense decoded or a message in a bottle? I think that's an idea when you break it down. That's simply, you can sort of see that it's not quite what happens. It's not the way we really understand what's going on with an artwork. So I found that if I dispense with the idea of content completely and focused on what happens on the viewer's end and try and look at that experience in a different way and not as an information transfer of some kind, that it ended up being a little more sensible to me.
How do you do that? How do you take your... It sounds like you're taking yourself out of the process of making the art. I mean, are you making this art from what you think is the viewer's perspective?
Well, what it takes out, maybe just to go back to your original comment, is the idea of expression in a certain sense. Like there's something internal in me necessarily that's kind of trying to crawl its way out or whatever through the medium of art. And I think there are certain problems in the vocabulary that we use around this, like the idea of a medium vessel content, meaning things like that, all imply to some degree kind of discrete package of
right.
something that's being transferred. So even if we don't completely believe in this kind of paradigm of the communicative aspect of art, we still have other kinds of ways of talking about it that sort of reinforce it. So what I'm looking at more from my side is what's happening on the viewer's end. How can I present an experience to the viewer that's going to be engaging, maybe that's going to give them an experience which is full, interesting, something like that.
So you're saying there's obviously there's no narrative in your work then, right?
I wouldn't say so, no.
No, okay. I mean, that's a really interesting thing, because one of the reasons I started this show was to try and close that gap between the viewer who walks in, who doesn't have maybe a lot of experience about art, and walks in and has that cliched response of, well, I could have done that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and the answer to that, of course, is, well, you didn't. But what you're addressing is, is that art, especially sophisticated art, and especially art these days, can sometimes require an extraordinary amount of information in order to be able to decode these, in order to be able to walk in and look at it and go, other than just on a purely visual context, you know, the pleasing to the eye, which a lot of artists find sort of an anathema. You know, it's like, I don't make paintings that are pleasing to the eye. You know, don't so insult me that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these paintings are about something much greater than that. And you're saying that yours just sort of skips that step, or skips that. You don't start with like an idea that you're trying to express, or a concept that you're trying to express, or a an insight into life that you're trying to represent through painting. Am I understanding you correctly?
Yes, that's correct. I mean, I don't
that's
see
fairly it. Radical. I
don't think so, really. No? I mean, I think it sort of takes some basic assumptions that if you explain them in a certain way, or we would all pretty much agree on. In other words, you know, we would accept right off the bat that that everyone's going to have a kind of individual interpretation of a work, that there's
right.
not going to be agreement about a piece. So what does that mean? I mean, first of all, it means that, you know, if there was agreement, then you might be able to make the argument that there's something essential being moved or transformed or communicated through the medium of the artwork. Since there isn't, you've already started to raise the question of that.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, you also have the viewer autonomy question. I mean, the viewer's going to have their own experience. And that's just the way it's going to be, and there's nothing you can do about that, and that's the way it should be. So looking at these dynamics in this way,
uh-huh.
I just ended up in a place where it just made a lot more sense to take the idea of content out
right.
And focus on other things. And think
like
about
what other things?
Well, presenting an experience to the viewer,
uh-huh.
for instance, you know, thinking about what the viewer is going to be seeing, posing questions.
All right, if you're not using content in your work, and if you're
right.
not using narrative in your work,
right,
then try and help me understand a little better, because you've talked about it a little bit, then what is your work about? And you started to talk about your work is about posing questions to the viewer, or having having this, I guess, just be an experience for the viewer, however they want to interpret that experience.
Correct.
Right, is that kind of it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the questions you're posing, there isn't a question you're posing.
Right.
There's just sort of, here it is, you figure it out, whether it, you know, whether it touches you, whether it brings up. Well, it's almost like a Rorschach. I mean, is that sort of what you're saying?
Well, let's
I mean, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to be insulted.
Sure. No, but
I mean, in a sense, that's kind of what a Rorschach is. It's like this sort of, you know, there is no content, there is no, it's what you, you know, what do you see in this?
Well, the difference is, I think, in a Rorschach test, you're making a determinative evaluation of what the person says post-experience, you know, post this person.
Right. I mean, what's missing here is a psychiatrist. So maybe you should have psychiatrists at your opening.
Maybe poets would be a better idea. I'm thinking of...
would be a better idea?
Well, think about like a haiku or something like that. One
right.
that I always use as an example is one by Basho where he says something like... lightning flash, what I thought were faces are leaves of pampas grass.
Right.
So you have a situation where you have all these sort of evaluative faculties involved in trying to analyze
uh-huh.
dark vision that you're seeing, and you're completely convinced of what you're seeing. The light comes on, you see something else.
Right.
We've all had that experience.
Right.
That's a certain fracture. It opens up a space in the mind and in your life for something new. And maybe that's an example of what perhaps could happen in a painting where you're not sort of focusing on content, more focusing on what's happening in the experience of the viewer.
Right. Okay. All right. How about the materials that you use? The paintings I was looking at, there was a lot of gray, you know, on the surface.
Right.
That was very, you know, flat, just flat gray. I guess those are gessoed on a canvas and then painted gray. Is that right?
Yes.
And then as far as materials, your materials are incredibly thick. Are you using resins in there? What are you using? I mean, some of them are coming off the canvas by an inch or more.
Right. Those are generally acrylic gels.
Oh, they are? Okay.
Yeah. So I'll start with canvas over a panel. I use a panel so I can work horizontally and pour and manipulate the fluids more easily. And then after that goes on some acrylic gel, which is built up to a height of anywhere between half inch or an inch.
Right.
I usually use a compositional sketch to lay that down because once that's down, that stays down. It can't move. And then I'll work with silver and white paint to build up a kind of foggy kind of surface that you see, so which is the base of the paintings.
Right.
And then heavier oil paint goes on top of that, as well as other materials such as alkyd gels and things like that.
But why gray? I mean, that's such an interesting sort of choice. Do you know why you chose the gray?
Well, it was another opportunity to kind of bring a kind of disjunction into the painting. I think there's one way of looking at painting traditionally, which is a sort of Renaissance space, looking into a window as if we could sort of reach in with our hands and that illusion of space that's created. So I think the void sort of addresses that. It's a little ambiguous how deep it is or could be, how far it goes back. And I work very hard to create a surface with that both has a kind of grain and grit but also has a kind of spatial illusion as well. But then you throw that against the physicality of the paint where you've got another idea about painting, which is the painting is object, where the painting is built up and coming out at you into space, has a body just like you have a body. And it's a reminder that you're looking at something that's both an image and an object at the same time.
Have you had an opportunity to talk to people much about the work and their response to the work? How about responses you've gotten here? Because here, we haven't talked about, here is 1708,
right,
which is a gallery that most everybody in town in Richmond knows about on Broad Street. It's been around for years. It's an artist-run space, probably the oldest one in the country now. I can't believe it. I remember the first night it opened. Have you gotten response? Have you talked to people about your work here a bunch?
I have, yeah. I'd like to say thanks on the air to the gallery. It's just been a wonderful experience to be able to come down here and show the work. Be invited to do that and to work with the people there at the gallery who are terrific. So
good.
I really enjoyed that. And yeah, you know, we've had some interesting conversations. I think, you know, it's the same situation. I get a lot of different responses to the same paintings. So no one seems to look at them in the same way, and that's perfectly fine. That's
Yeah, because I was talking to a lot of people last night who I don't think really understood the paintings, which was interesting to me. And, you know, I looked at them and, you know, we're all sort of looking at it in terms of the way we always look at paintings. You know, okay, so what's the content? Is there a narrative in here? You know, what's going on here? But, you know, what I was interested sort of in talking to you about is some of the things that we have talked about. But in a sense, the paintings are kind of a mystery to me. So could you help me sort of unravel that mystery a little bit? I mean, I know we've done some of that, but is there anything more you can say about what it is? Because it sounds like you're trying to do something that, at least to me, seems to be sort of cutting edge in terms of the use of paint and what paint can express and what paint can, well, what paint can or cannot communicate. Is that accurate?
Yeah. I mean, I think that it seems like what I'm doing for reasons that seem kind of commonsensical. I don't.
To you.
Well, organically, I just don't know how else to proceed. I mean, you know, if you're going to have, you know, recognized complete viewer autonomy, then you don't need or want the artist to kind of validate the experience of the viewer. So it's not my place. It's not my business. It's not my authority to do that. So, you know, I'm a maker of objects. I have reasons why I make them, why I do. And I put them into the world. And then
why do you make them? What drives you to do this?
I'm not really sure.
That's a wonderfully honest answer.
Yeah.
I
mean,
yeah, really, you know, yeah.
something is doing it. I mean, I stopped for a while several years ago to do a reevaluation of what I was doing.
Yeah, talk about that a little bit, because that was interesting. That was in on your website, I think.
Yeah, I spoke about it a little bit just on the blog, kind of to frame what I'm hoping to get to when I get back. But there was a moment when there were some events in my life that were important and critical, and I started looking at painting and thinking about how I was addressing them or not addressing them in the work. And I came to the conclusion that I wasn't and really couldn't.
What were those issues? Can you talk about them? Or are they...
No, they're personal issues.
They're personal issues, okay.
And
but you were at one point drawing from those personal issues. You were doing what most artists...
I guess I thought I was.
And then all of a sudden you went, wait a minute here.
Maybe I thought I had been for some period of time.
Yeah, interesting.
But then the more I get into the idea of how the whole the content issue worked and what's happening in the dynamic, the less I had faith that that could be done and that was a place for it. But I think other things can happen. So, I mean, the painting is the place where I do my work. I put a lot of thought into it. I do a lot of physical work to put it together. I can really make it a vessel for a lot of kinds of meditations and things like that and other kinds of activities that I'm working with. I'm using my body, I'm using my mind, I'm using my, you know, eyes and other sensory faculties. And I love that about painting.
Right.
You know, you really have a range of experience that you're working with when you're doing it. The question is, what's happening on the other side? It seems to me very difficult to make the argument that, you know, you have some kind of direct line that's coming from me to you, the message in a bottle, the sort of artist telegram thing. So if that's not happening, then what's left? How do you deal with that? How do you work with that? And those are the sort of things I'm sort of working through right now.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here. We're talking to Christopher Quirk, whose paintings have been exhibited since 1990 in galleries both in the United States and abroad. He's currently showing at 1708 Gallery on Broad Street. He most recently received a grant award from the Kittredge Fund of Augusta, Maine. He holds an MFA in painting from the Tyler School of Art in Rome and Philadelphia, and an MA in liberal arts education from the Graduate Institute of St. John's College in Santa Fe. Now back to our interview. So you think you'll keep painting, or do you think you'll find another way to... I mean, you're not... Because, you know, you obviously have thought about this a lot. You're not just making decorative work. This is not what this is about. This is not just about, you know, I made this, you know, image that I think is interesting to look at. You take it from there.
Well, it wouldn't be for me to say. I mean, someone may take a painting of mine, perhaps, and put it on their wall because they just like the way it looks. I mean, that's perfectly fine. I mean, the artist makes the work. You know, you put it on a raft and kick it out into the water, and after that, it's no longer yours.
Right.
You know, it's the world's job to decide what they want to do with it and how it fits into the culture at large.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some other things here. You had mentioned in your artist statement well, let me just read this, and let's just see where this goes. But you'd said, my paintings direct their focus to the viewer's experience, which we've sort of talked about, and away from the notion of painting itself as a bearer of content, which we have talked about. Discordant components and qualities in each painting pose questions for the viewer, suspending resolution and providing a space for the viewer's own meditations. The idea is to give, not tell, and for the painting to provide an experience that unfolds over time. So is there anything more you want to say about that? I mean, I think we've talked about that a bit, but is there anything more you want to say about that?
Well, just to say maybe that this idea isn't necessarily new or my own or anything else. I mean, these ideas have been around in the art world for a while, going back at least as far as someone like Robert Irwin, who tries to focus his own attention to the viewer's experience in terms of taking the hand of the artist completely out of the equation, making things that don't have any objectness at all, or where the objectness is not visible.
Right.
So I think there's precedent for these things, and I think there's a sort of conversation going on about it at the same time. And you know, my work maybe is just a part of that.
Yeah. So. I mean, one of the things that unfortunately are at a disadvantage here is my ignorance in that area. but
well, we're also not looking at objects either. We're talking in words, so
I know.
You can't refer to that.
But talk a little bit more about Robert Irwin, because you mentioned him and you just now.
Yeah, sure.
Talk about that, because that might help our listeners understand a little better.
Well, he's someone I've been looking at for about 25 years.
Wow.
And he's had a kind of transformation. He started off as a painter, primarily an abstract painter, and had a sort of point in his life where he sort of looked at what he was doing and said, you know, what is it that I have to tell anybody in a certain mm-hmm. sense? Mm-hmm. I'd much rather try and find another way to work with art and, mm-hmm. and not sort of deal with it as a kind of place for, well, I'm going to repeat myself here, some kind of information transfer or declarative statement or however you want to phrase it. So he started after a period of study and meditation to do projects where he focused on making the viewer aware of having a visual experience or
right.
having a sensory experience,
right.
Kind of, you know, quote-unquote contentless, mm-hmm. maybe, if you mm-hmm. want to put mm-hmm. it that way, mm-hmm. Mode of working, even to the point where he would try and eliminate the visible hand of the artist from all of his projects. At one point, he did something in a museum where he was given a white room with a black splashboard around three sides of it mm-hmm. And an open space for the fourth side. He just put a piece of black tape on the floor, mm-hmm. which matched up with the splashboard, which even people that had worked in the museum for quite a long time didn't even notice. Other people were coming up and approaching it as if it were a piece of glass or something like that. So really sort of making a distinctive visual experience for people who are looking at it and being in that room without, you know, much intervention at all, very
right.
spare
very
kind
spare.
Of way of looking at things. So,
in a sense, it's a minimal approach. In a sense.
Well, that one was certainly.
Yeah.
I think he's done other things, of course, that are more ornate.
And I wouldn't call your work minimal, by you know.
No.
No. Any. No. No. Uh-uh. Okay. Yeah. What about Nathaniel Dorsky? He's a filmmaker that apparently has influenced you.
Right.
Talk about him a little bit.
I just found out about him about a year ago. As a matter of fact, my wife Amy and I were here a year ago to help Hope Ginsburg install mm-hmm. her project at the space, Solvent Space, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah. So while we were there.
The Sponge Project?
Yes, the Sponge Project, exactly. So while we were there, Amy pointed out to me an article on Forum, which was written by P. Adam Sidney, who's kind of the dean of mm-hmm. avant-garde film writing in the U.S., on Dorsky. So I tracked down some of his films at the Museum of Modern Art and went and saw a bunch of them and found some things that were very interesting, very compelling.
Well, let me just inject something. Cause
sure,
let me
go ahead.
Sort of when we sat down, you know, and I've sort of referenced this, you know, I sort of looked at your paintings and I kind of went, you know, gosh, what, you know, I don't know how, these are very different.
Mm-hmm.
These are really different paintings. I don't know how to respond to these. What am I going to ask this guy on the show today? And what's really been interesting to me is that it sounds like you have forced yourself, partly through life experience and partly through just intellectual honesty, to say, okay, what am I really doing here that I can honestly, intellectually, and honestly, and emotionally say I am doing something that makes sense to me in terms of art making and then is something that can be received by the public in you know, whatever context or whichever way they want to receive that.
Right.
So what it sounds like to me is that you put yourself on this almost very rigorous path with certain kinds of limitations that are limiting but also very freeing, and that your journey is still very much an active struggle to figure out how it is you want to or what it is you want to how and what it is you want to communicate through painting, and that's sort of your exploration. Am I getting that?
I would say yes, except in as much as it doesn't feel like a struggle in a sense. Do you know what I mean?
I mean,
just what I get up every day and I do, and some things make sense, and I try and go that way, and then other things don't. I try and stay away from them. I mean, you know, I'm presenting things that maybe have potential multiple interpretations or references or associations and things like that, and that's very deliberate,
right.
And that's fine. The images or the artifacts or the whatever you want to call them that make their way into the paintings come from a generative sort of impulse in me. I'm sitting down doing some drawing, just you know, finding these things and then deciding how to use them and work them into the paintings and things like that. And I'm having you know, a wonderful time sort of working through these things and thinking about them. And there's lots of stuff that's going on in my head as I'm working, and I feel like I'm able to work with a really broad range of sort of intellectual and physical activity, as I said.
Right.
But what happens on the other end is something I just don't have a whole lot of information on, and it isn't really sort of my...
The things that go through your brain, are those things you can articulate, or are they just totally visual? You know, I mean, a lot of painters will say, look, Tim, if I could write about it, or if I could talk about it, I'd write a book about it. You know, that's why I paint.
Cause well, that's right. Yeah.
It's not,
I think that's what visual art it comes down to in the end. Yeah. It's not easy to do a painting. It takes time. You know, other art forms aren't easy either. But
right.
In some ways, as you said, if you could sit down and just write it out, you'd save some labor and some other materials and resources.
You'd save some materials anyway. So. It's a lot cheaper to print something out on a printer than it is to paint it on a canvas. Absolutely.
There you go.
Is there anything that you wanted to say that we've sort of skipped around? Or,
well, I think I have a friend, Glenn Davis, who told me once. He said, you know, art may not give you what you think you need, but it gives you what you really need. So, you know, you may not get a lot of other material benefits from it necessarily. But, you know, I wake up in the morning and I know what I'm going to do with my day.
Yeah.
And that's a wonderful thing. I know some people that don't have that necessarily. And so I feel very lucky to have that.
You know, there's one thing else I wanted to ask you about. I don't know if we'll use it in here. But in your paintings, for instance, in Refrain, there are sort of, I don't know what to call them. They look like nipples.
Yeah.
On the paintings. I mean, that was sort of my first response was like, you know, what are those nipples doing in there?
Right.
Is there any reference to anything like that? I'm sounds like I'm trying to trick you. Tell them what's the reference.
What is it for real, right?
Yeah. So you can say to me, well, Tim, if they look like nipples to you, then I guess they are.
Well, I think, you know, everything that I put in there, I've deliberately sort of worked to make sure it has sort of multiple references, multiple interpretive possibilities, if you want to use several words in place of one. So, again, I work to sort of keep things up in the air, keep things sort of suspended for the viewer so things don't lock down. I'm opposed to, it wouldn't be interesting to me to make a kind of painting where, you know, you sort of look at it, understand it very quickly, lock it up and move on to the next thing. So I'd much rather provide an experience which extends over time, which asks questions and provides a forum for the viewer's own meditations.
You just said it. That was it. That was great. You just, the whole half an hour, you just nailed.
Okay, well, thank you. And I'm going to use your full name, Christopher Gwork, which is a wonderful name.
Wasn't my idea.
But anyway, it's a great name. Thank you, Christopher Gwork, for talking with us today. Thank you, folks, for listening. We hope to see you on the radio again next Friday at 12:30. This is Tim Bowring, and you're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond's Indie Radio. It's radio for the rest of us.